Chris, how much responsibility does that put on your back as Deputy Director of Smithsonian to make a lot of these things happen?
Well, I would not in a moment try to compare myself to Don. I think he had a remarkable life, a remarkable person, but in a humble way we'll try to carry on that tradition, a tradition of excellence, hard work, and he really was quite humorous. I mean, even in spite of it all, he never lost his perspective and his grounding. And we were talking earlier about, you know, gas in or lack of in the CBI, and I remember he was asked a question. He said, by General Daley, actually, he said, how did you get around? How did you navigate? And there's a long pause, and Don kind of tilted his head and thought, and he said, come to think of it, I don't know how we got to where we needed to go. But he would give you that sense of, it would be a little bit misleading, because he was very polished and very accomplished at what he did. As I said, he went on to become an engineer with Apollo program. He was a scholar. He wrote several books. I've not written a book. Don't know if that's in the works. But certainly take to heart the lessons and the standards of excellence that he has set for myself and others to follow. So it truly is a privilege and honor to be able to even associate myself in my current role with such a great American hero.
You mentioned about, yeah, Warren.
Well, we had an opportunity a few years ago, and Chris took us through the Hazy Center and gave us a tour, and I feel very confident that they're doing a great job of carrying on the both facilities. You know, the downtown facility is going through a major renovation right now, but they're keeping half of it open so that people can still visit it, because I think it's still the most visited museum in the world, right?
Absolutely. And, yeah, over 8 million people a year.
Yeah, and the Hazy Center and the restoration facility there, and the openness that they have to work with other restorers and help other restorers, definitely the organization is carrying on its duty, its commitment, and its willingness to help, and that's really encouraging to see from your organization.
You know, you just mentioned about Don, about humor. To what extent does the way the federal government operates allow you to use humor in your presentations?
Well, there are a couple stories I'd love to tell.
Yeah.
I know we're being filmed, so I probably will forgo some of them out here. But things are a little bit more constrained, I suppose, in a way. But I do think as we go through challenges, whatever they may be, that we not lose our perspective and our sense of humor. And it really is important. I mean, we are rebuilding the entire museum on the Mall. It's a massive program.
Explain that for everybody here, would you? And for those listening on TV.
Well, again, as you know, the Smithsonian is a nation's museum. It was built and opened in 1976. And Don was serving at the museum at that time with Mike Collins, who was the director. And after 40 years, it's shown its age, and to sort of equate what that level of visitorship means, imagine yourself living in a 2,500-square-foot home and having 148 people over for dinner every night for 40 years. What would your house look like? Well, the museum is worn out, and we literally have to take the stone off the outside, replace it with longer-duration stone. And to do that means emptying the galleries and everything inside the museum. It's actually a $650 million funded program by the government. But the real touch point are the galleries themselves, 23, all of which are going to be redone. And that is reliant on private philanthropy. So that's a lot of what we're about, is trying to engage with our supporters to help us tell these stories with these aircraft and artifacts in a way that goes the next 100 years. And, you know, the generation, as noted, coming through our doors today is different than the generation 40 years ago. So we have to remain contemporary and tell these stories in a way that is every bit as impactful and as meaningful, but in ways that resonate. You know, most of what we do is trying to, well, educate. My email address is si.edu. We are educators. And as such, one of the things we're very hard working towards and mindful of is the developing the workforce for the aerospace industry? How do we get people energized at a young age and continue with that interest so that they can be the mechanics, the pilots, the designers, the engineers that this industry desperately needs? And so whether it's telling the story in a very visual, impactful way that can create that spark, or having a museum where we try to do that, we're all in this together. And we really see ourselves as educators and storytellers for the next generation.
And importantly, Warren referred to it, you will not completely close the museum while you're doing all this, right?
People should understand it. It makes it a longer project. It's basically 2-3-year projects because we're doing a half at a time. And if you were to visit the mall today, just about half of our museum is closed. And we had to move everything out to our restoration facility at Dulles and build facilities for that. And I don't need to tell this crowd, but our artifacts are not flat paintings typically. They're very large aircraft, and so we have to disassemble these aircraft and take them to our facilities at Dulles, where they'll undergo additional restoration, and most of them be reintroduced back into the galleries as we reopen. But at any time, we'll always have the spirit of St. Louis, the Wright Flyer, on display, so we would certainly encourage you to come by. We will remain open. And as Warren and Bruce have noted, the Udvar-Hazy is its own immense facility, and that remains fully open and operational.
One last question. As you look at this airplane, there are a couple of odd-looking things hanging below the wings. What are they, and what is their purpose?
Is there anybody here that doesn't recognize a keg of beer? So there's some great stories online. One of the easy places to look it up was called Beer Barrel Bombers. But after D-Day, they initiated a program, the British did initially, with Spitfires, hauling beer in cleaned-out drop tanks over to the troops on the front lines. And if you think about it, beer, especially in England, was kind of a staple. And it's also, it's sanitized water. It was a little bit of nourishment and a little bit of courage and bringing a little bit of home. It was a morale builder. So they were hauling beer in there, but the troops, although they were more than willing to drink it all, did complain of a little bit of residual fuel taste in the beer. So then they converted over and started actually hauling kegs of beer, wooden casks, and they would haul them like this, or they would even build... They would take the tips, the backside of drop tanks, and streamline them a little bit by putting them on there. But there's pictures of Spitfires, Typhoons, and Mustangs hauling wood beer casks. So we've replicated that by taking some modern kegs, filled them with root beer, which we're going to offer everybody a glass of root beer that wants one afterwards, courtesy of...
Tap it off the wing.
Yeah, yeah. Dakota Territory Air Museum and Warbirds and Review and Air Corps. We're kind of bringing this to people and ask you if you want to stick around and have a beer off of the pylon of a Mustang. This is your opportunity to do so. But it's a really unique story, and they actually hauled so much beer out of England that they had to taper it off because they were running low on beer in England. And I think that's an awesome thing.
But, it's another reflection of the depth of honesty and specificity to restoring these airplanes 100% accurately.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you very much to Warren and Bruce and Chris. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And now welcome, please, Sam Bass, who is, 6,000 hours of pilot time? Is that close enough, Sam?
35.
And 50 years of safe flying as well. Sam, you're on to talk to the guys.
Yeah, and I'll let Warren, would you get up and just, let's talk about the P-51 for a little bit, if you will.
Okay.
And well, you can sit. You can lay down if you like.
There you go.
But anyway, let's just go over and stand in front of this Lord's Hope here. And tell me just about the P-51 itself, the whole design. What was the design purpose for the P-51?
Again, the British government are the ones that came to North America and asked for an airplane to be designed. I believe the U.S. government initially came and asked them to build airplanes under contract. Love to have these guys jump in here if I'm saying something wrong, but they wanted to build the government wanted North American to build P-40s under license, and North American said, I think we can do something quicker and better. And the British government contract with North American, and they drew something up on a napkin and were able to fly the airplane within 120 days, which was remarkable. And they obviously stepped away from the old thought process of everything being round and difficult to build and said, we're going to throw away all the French curves and take the rulers out and start drawing straight lines and build a fast-to-build, simpler airplane. But in doing so, they designed one of the most iconic and beautiful airframes ever designed. The A model Mustang, which there's a, EAA has an example over here in the A36, initially came out with the Allison engine. And it was, I think, a really good airplane, but the Allison didn't have the high altitude capability that the Rolls-Royce Merlin did. So the British modified an airplane, correct? Then they put the Merlin on the front of an A model airframe, basically, and decided, wow, this could really be something. So North American went back and they started to build the P-51 B and C, which are the same airplane, just built in different factories, one in California, one in Texas. And they built that airplane, as you see it here, the Razorback version or whatever, with the birdcage canopy and things. And as the airplane evolved, it was it became the long-range fighter escort. It was, and I don't think a lot of people realize how extensively it was used in the Pacific theater. You know, it wasn't just the ETO where they went to Germany with it, but they were using it to get all the way into Japan to escort the B-29s at the end of the war, with the external tanks, the aft tank and the fuselage and the internal fuel, the airplane had an unbelievable duration. I know that our guy from North Dakota told me a few times that he was on 8-hour missions where they would leave England, fly a mission and go through, as they exited the mission, end up over in Russia or someplace, you know, with the airplane to get fuel and come back, which is, at this age, I can't imagine sitting for 8 hours in a Mustang. I think that would hurt a lot, but pretty remarkable airplane, and